from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Writer Salman Rushdie's new novel, Quichotte, is set in an unstable, perilous America where anything can happen. Old friends could become new enemies, and traditional enemies could be your new besties or even lovers, he writes. It was no longer possible to predict the weather or the likelihood of war or the outcomes of elections. A layered book within a book, it's Rushdie's character, spy novel writer Sam Duchamp, who is penning the story of Quichotte, a Don Quixote of the digital age embarking on a quest to find his true love. Rushdie will be joining us to talk about the novel and what it says about America today. That's next, right after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Writer Salman Rushdie is our guest for this forum hour. He's the author of close to 20 books, including the Booker Prize-winning Midnight's Children. Rushdie became a household name back in the late 80s when his novel The Satanic Verses upset some in the Muslim world, including Ayatollah Khomeini, who issued an order for his assassination, that is, Rushdie's assassination. And he joins us now to discuss his new novel, Quichotte, which is a modern-day take on the famous satirical novel Don Quixote. And welcome back to the forum program, Salman Rushdie.
Hello, Michael. Nice to be back on the show with you.
Yeah, delighted to have you back. And I must say that this book is getting worldwide attention. We were just talking about worldwide attention to climate change, and it's about many, many things, including climate change. But I think I would like to begin by saying that, and get your response to this, it really establishes you as in some ways an American novelist. And I mean that in the sense that Bharati Mukherjee, for example, originally from India, said she became so identified with America that she felt that she was really and ought to be categorized as an American novelist.
Well, I think it's been coming for a while, you know. I mean, the last three novels have all been very, very much set in different bits of the United States. And I think this one, has, you know, there's a little bit that is set in London and a little bit of backstory that's set in Bombay. But yeah, the bulk of it is an American novel, and I very much wanted it to be.
And it reminds me of a commercial I used to hear as a kid, See the USA in Your Chevrolet. There is a main character, in fact, who's going across the whole American terrain, and we get a kind of Nabokovian view of the world through his eyes and his odyssey. And the book is so many things that, you know, I'm reluctant to give away much of the plot here, but I want to talk about it in terms of, first of all, your work, and your what Larry David once described to me as oeuvre. He pronounced it with that long O. There's a real hierarchy for many novelists who have accomplished as much as you have. You know, they're all your children since Midnight's Children, and you love them all. This one, I suspect, as a reader, has maybe a special place in your heart.
I do you know, sometimes when you finish a book, you have a sort of little bit of an extra feeling about it. And I think really since I finished Midnight's Children, which was, I mean, when I was a kid, I was 33 then, almost 40 years later at the age of 72, I have the same kind of feeling about this book. So, of course, what you don't know is if the world will agree with you. But I felt when I finished it that maybe this one was a little bit special.
Well, I read the book with great interest, particularly I found myself asking, does Rushdie really watch that much television? I mean, because you were immersed.
Well, he had to.
You had to.
I had to do it, yeah.
Well, you immerse us in the world of television, basically.
I mean, if you're going to write a novel about a character who's been, in a way, driven a little crazy by watching too much crappy television, then you've got to watch it. And so I did my due diligence, and I watched enormous amounts of Bachelors and Bachelorettes and Kardashians and you know, all the garbage that's out there, until I began to understand how easy it would be to be driven crazy by it.
It did not affect your cognitive abilities or reduce your IQ?
It could have done if I'd kept doing it. But I did as much as I needed to do, basically. And now, mercifully, I don't have to do it anymore.
Again, we're talking to Salman Rushdie. His new book is Quichotte. And it's really inspired by Don Quixote and the whole myth of the knight and his pursuit of the damsel and all that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, it started from Even before I thought about Don Quixote, I wanted to write a road novel. I wanted to write a novel which went across the country and became, in a way, different kinds of adventure, different points on the road, you know, because that's one of the things you can do with that kind of format, that as your character travels along his own road, down life's road, as it were, his experiences can be very radically different. So I wanted this kind of metamorphic book. And then I thought about Don Quixote, and I picked it up and looked at it again. And immediately, my characters, my variations of Quixote and Sancho Panza popped into my head, who are in many ways quite different from Cervantes' characters. I mean, Cervantes' Sancho is a man. He's extremely earthy and real, whereas my Sancho is a teenage boy who's sort of literally wished into existence by his lonely father.
And his lonely father is wished into existence by a spy novelist. And that spy novelist is wished into existence by Salman Rushdie.
By me, yes, I know. There's a few layers going on here. But that, of course, is also true about Don Quixote, because Cervantes pretends all the way through his novel that he's actually only repeating the content of a book written by somebody else, which is, in fact, an imaginary Arab writer, Sidi Hamete Benengeli, who he says is the real author. And then at a certain point, the Benengeli text runs out, and Cervantes magically finds another account of the adventures of Don Quixote, which begins fantastically exactly where the first one leaves off. So he's playing those games with authorship too.
Well, this is what we call metafiction these days, I suppose, but it's also satire and it's labyrinthine and it's postmodern, post-postmodern, I guess. And yet, you know what I found myself thinking of as I was reading through this, because you're playing so much with the idea of fact and fiction and real news and false news and imagination versus what we call reality. I found myself thinking about an essay, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that was written many years ago by Philip Roth, where he said, things have become so distorted and perhaps so surreal that we can't tell the real from the imaginary. And things that happen in real life are things that dwarf our imaginations, make us realize how diminished our imaginations are.
Well, I mean, he was right then, and it's so much more true now than it was then. And I just wanted, therefore, to take all that on and to take it on in a broadly speaking, in a kind of comic voice. You know, I think the world has become so crazy and ridiculous that maybe comedy is the way of dealing with it, I thought. And one of the things that's most pleased me in these early days since the book came out is that people have been telling me that they think it's the funniest of my books. And that I think is a point of pride. You know, it's actually harder to make people laugh than to make them cry. So if you can make them laugh, you've done something worth doing, I think.
Well, it's a point of pride that you and I have had a long-standing friendship and have done many interviews together, and I have told you on a number of occasions, both on stage and on the air, that I think you are very funny, and people yet still associate you with Khomeini and the Satanic Verses and the fatwa and all of that, and think that therefore
I know, because that wasn't funny, people think that I'm not. You know, and I've had any number of people read my books and then say to me, who knew that you were funny? And the answer is, people who read my books know. So I recommend that people do that.
Or people who have interviewed you or have heard you being interviewed, I would add to that, too. There's, as I said, this, what we call patterned, labyrinthine novelist writing about a novelist and you, the novelist behind that. In fact, the humor also comes in kind of the private little, maybe even slightly esoteric jokes. He is pursuing, Quixote pursued Dulcinea, he is pursuing a TV star, a kind of Oprah TV star from India originally named Salma R. And of course, one can't help thinking of Salman R., the author.
Yes, well, that was my little personal joke. You know, people are always these days trying to find which character in a novel is the autobiographical character. So I thought I'd have a character whose name is one syllable, one letter away from mine, but who is, first of all, a woman, secondly, suffers from advanced bipolar condition, and thirdly, is addicted to opioids. And I think if anybody asks which is the autobiographical character, I'd say, well, it's that one.
You also had a sister who was addicted to opioids, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I mean, that's in a way one of the origin points of the sort of more serious part of this book. that my youngest, I now have three sisters, my youngest sister, 14 years younger than myself, died 12 years ago, very young, at the age of 45, and the cause was opioid overdose. And that, I mean, also it was very sad because she was far away in another country across an ocean and a continent, and I didn't have any idea that she was so, had become so dependent on these things. And then, you know, you feel guilty and sad, and it made me want to know everything I could find out about these things. And so for the last decade, not full time, but I have been digging into this subject, and eventually felt ready to write about it when I started this book. And then, you know, by some curious coincidence, just as the book comes out, this thing explodes into the news. And suddenly every day in the news, we have something about Purdue Pharma, the manufacturers of OxyContin, or Johnson & Johnson, or, you know, these large fines being levied on them. So suddenly it's a big story, whereas for many years it's been a kind of invisible story.
Well, you do take on, we shouldn't make this seem like it's all satire and comedy, because you do take on very serious, and in that case, a very serious as well as personal charge as a novelist. You also, in fact, move us into a territory, as you often do, that's political. I mean, I see the conjunction here between the United States under Trump and India under Modi and England under Boris Johnson.
Yeah, I think they're all in trouble. It's not exactly the same situation, but there are, I think, strong echoes between them, and that's in a way one of the reasons why at a certain point in the book, it develops a kind of science fiction idea of a kind of end of the world idea, and it seemed to me that what I was trying to say was that the worlds of these three countries, which I spent my life writing about and thinking about, are in danger of disintegrating. You know, the reality as we have known it is crumbling, and we're not quite sure what's going to come next.
Well, that's where climate change fits in. As I said, we just did a segment on it in the last hour, and I see that we had a young woman on who's very dedicated youth activist, belongs to a group called Youth versus the Apocalypse, essentially, trying to save the planet.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why there's a kind of apocalypse theme at one point in the book, and I think it very much has to do with climate change.
And it also has a great deal to do with love. I mean, in that case, I'm also thinking again, perhaps, of writers like Nabokov or others. Auden comes to mind, so many who feel that maybe love is the answer. Love is what maybe can save us.
It sounds almost sentimental to say so, but I do believe that that's the case. And in this book, I've tried to write about different kinds of love, not just romantic love. You know, romantic love in the novel is represented by Quichotte's obsession with Salma R. And it's treated, for a lot of the novel, is treated kind of comically, because it's ridiculous that this old duffer in Gallup, New Mexico, believes that he can win the hand of one of the most famous women in America, who's also, of course, much younger than him and much richer than him and much more famous and powerful than him. But nevertheless, he sets out and says repeatedly that love will find a way. But I also wanted to write about other kinds of love inside families. Love, father and son relationships are very important in this book. In both the storylines, there's a father and a son trying to get along, trying to improve their relationship. And brother-sister relationships are very important in this book. In both storylines, there's a brother and a sister who have become estranged and who are seeing if they can mend the rift between them. So the subject of forgiveness is very important. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of playful fun in this book, I hope. But underneath it all, there's this, I think, is the emotional heart of the book.
And they said you couldn't do anything with a novel after James Joyce's Ulysses, right?
Well, when I first read Ulysses, that's what I thought too. You know, when I read it at university, I thought, well, there's nothing left to do. But it turns out that I've managed to do something or other for the last decades now. Almost 40 years.
And you also keep us to the point of view of this somewhat cracked protagonist of yours, who is obviously optimistic, idealistic in so many ways, but is able to get along in the lopsided world, and maybe reflective of a certain kind of survival instinct that one must have or ought to have?
Well, he's a kind of holy fool, isn't he? I mean, he is sort of an idiot.
And,
he is in some ways an idiot, but he's also very hopeful and very positive, and he believes in the good. In the good, you know, he's trying throughout the novel to be worthy of this woman he hopes to win, and to be worthy, he must become a better person. And so, the novel is really about somebody trying to be good, and that is something I wanted to project, to send that person, this this moral, hopeful, optimistic person, on a journey across America which may not be at its most optimistic moment.
And a journey which, since he is a brown man, involves some rather unpleasant racism that's out there in the American hinterland.
Yeah, well, you know, in Don Quixote, particularly in the first couple of hundred pages of Don Quixote, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza are always getting beaten up and left in a ditch. It happens like slightly too often, you know. You begin to wish that Cervantes could stop doing it. But I thought my version of that is that you can't send two Indian American people across America in a Chevy Cruze and assume that no hostility will happen, you know, because we live in an age in which that kind of hostility is every day. And so I didn't want the book to be kind of a sermon about race, but I also didn't want to duck the issue. And so there are three moments in the book when they encounter hostility, sometimes just verbal hostility and sometimes actually physically dangerous. But I wanted to say that, there's that too. You know, there's that too in America as an everyday event right now.
And so much of your work has characteristically been not only about migrant consciousness and the obstacles that migrants face, but also about identity. And this work is no exception to those major themes, is it?
Well, I can't, you know, I've been an immigrant all my life. You know, first I was an immigrant from India to England and then from England to America. And so that way of seeing the world is my way of seeing the world, you know. And I mean, I've never written a novel which didn't have an Indian main character, even if the Indian main character is a diaspora character who's been living most of his life in the West. But somehow I have to see the world through Indian eyes, you know, and I do.
Which makes me think of a story that you probably know by Jhumpa Lahiri, another Indian writer of Indian descent, Indian American. It's a story called Third and Final Continent. It's about her father, basically, and her father's voice, and he goes from India to England and winds up in the United States. I started out asking you if you feel like an American novelist now, and in many ways, you were particularly, I think, feeling American after 9/11, or a New Yorker, certainly, to a great degree, weren't you? I mentioned that story because it's a very happy story about finding America as the ultimate third and final continent, but the home of...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I'm pretty much like the father in her story. I mean, I made the same journey and chose to make New York my home and feel it and think of it in that way, you know. And I mean, I've been a citizen now for a number of years, and I do remember the day of the 9/11 attacks when I felt exactly as if somebody had attacked my home. And it's the moment at which I realized that New York had actually become home, you know, and that I felt protective of it and loyal to it and loving towards it in the way that one feels towards one's home.
The book also, and I'm talking again about Quixote, Salman Rushdie with us, the author of 18 books, including The Satanic Verses, Midnight's Children, and now also an essayist and a children's book writer, a new novel called Quixote. I found that I was reacting to just the wide canvas that you have here and how extraordinary it is. Also, I keep thinking about something Newton Minow said, which you may know, back when he talked about television as the vast wasteland when he was chair of the FCC. This is a sense of your giving us the vast wasteland of America, isn't it? Also, as much as you may love America now and welcome it as your home.
Well, I don't think it's all wasteland. I think there's some good things.
No, TV is the wasteland. The junk culture is the wasteland.
Yeah. Well, reality TV is the wasteland, yes. I mean, there's a lot of TV that I love. I mean, I think television drama right now is at an all-time high, you know, in quality. And also, as I have admitted before on this book tour, I am deeply addicted to Law & Order SVU. So I watch that as kind of relaxation a lot of evenings, really.
Well, I don't find those episodes too relaxing. I find them, some of them, pretty disturbing, actually. But you also watch
that.
You and Camille Paglia watch The Housewives, I guess, don't you?
Well, I have watched my share of Housewives, but I'm not going there anymore. And of the various housewives, I thought I liked the ones from Atlanta the best.
Well, I mentioned Camille Paglia because she is so enthusiastic. She thinks it's really one of the best things, not only on television, but of popular culture or our American civilization culture in general. There's I mentioned Newton Minow, though, in that idea of TV is the vast wasteland, because to some extent, many people continue to view it that way, and they view it as something that's really a part of the problem now. A major part of the problem. We live with a president who lives for television.
Yeah, well, I do think it is the problem of reality television is well expressed in the form of Donald Trump. You know, I mean, he is the manifestation of reality television in the White House. And if you want the worst case scenario of reality TV, there it is. You know, but I think realistically, if you live in a world, a media world, which we all now inhabit, in which not only reality television, but across the internet as well, there's a kind of deliberate blurring of lines between fact and fiction. I think it leaves many people in a very confused state and finding it difficult to genuinely distinguish between fact and fiction. And that is something I wanted to explore.
On that note, let me invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation. Salman Rushdie with us, and his new book is called Quichotte. And welcome your thoughts and welcome any questions you may have for this most distinguished novelist and writer. And you can join us at our toll-free number. I invite you to do that. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Be part of the program by dialing in now at 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions to forum@kqed.org. Please feel free to bring your questions or comments to the fore here. And let me bring to the fore what I see as maybe a central theme underlying this novel. It may go back to your background from India and even Hinduism to a great extent, and that is Maya, illusion. I mean, it ties in with what you were just saying before about fact and fiction.
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea, I'd always been very interested in the idea of Maya, which is the idea that there is a veil which covers our eyes and makes it difficult for us to see things as they truly are. What we see is the illusion. We don't see the truth. And philosophy, mysticism, these things are supposed to be ways of removing the veil so that we can see the world as it truly is. And I mean, I think I'm not particularly a mystic myself, but I do think that one of the functions of literature is to try and show the world as it really is. Or at least as the author sees it. And I think what you do as a writer is you try and provide your vision of the world to say, you know, here's what I think, here's what I see. And then invite the reader to enter that world and to decide what they think about it. What do they think about the way in which I've shown the world? Do they agree with it? Do they disagree with it? Do they like inhabiting my version of it or not? That's the relationship between the writer and the reader, and important, I think, to remember that.
Well, let's again find out what your thoughts are about all this. We do invite your participation in the program, and we want to hear from you, and you can join us at 866-733-6786. Michael Krasny with Salman Rushdie. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. Our guest is Salman Rushdie. He is a novelist, an essayist, and an award-winning writer. In fact, I think the only person who has received the Booker Award twice, and this new novel is shortlisted as a Booker nominee. It's called Midnight. It's called Quichotte, and it's all about a young. It's a book which has two stories in it running parallel, is really what I meant to say. And before we went to the break, Salman Rushdie was talking about his vision and the interpretation of his vision and how you as readers might get involved with it and might be committed to it or might perhaps disagree with it. It's also really a book about how we're in this, I think what you've described, Salman, as a golden age of myth that has fueled populism and xenophobic politics. And that gets me back to what I said earlier about that connection between Modi and Johnson and Trump, perhaps. But there's also a sense of anything can happen in America now. I mean, America is totally unpredictable and totally improbable.
Yeah, I remember a little while ago, I was having dinner in New York with my friend Ian McEwan, and we were talking about this and saying, if we had tried to write a novel or propose a novel to our publishers in which we described everything that's actually happened in the last 3 years, the publishers would say, go away and think of something more realistic because this is not believable. You know, and we now live in this age in which unbelievable things happen every day, in which, you know, the president of the United States could decide that the way to deal with a hurricane is to attack it with a nuclear weapon. That's the sort of idea that if I tried to write a story about that, it would probably be rejected as being too implausible. And so the implausible is now the normal. That's what I meant when Quichotte describes this as the age of anything can happen. It's as if there's no borders to what can happen anymore. The most outrageous thing that you would think is completely implausible can turn out to be tomorrow's headline.
That's what we used to call surreal, didn't we?
Yeah, and it's not only about politics. It's also about the enormous rapid change of in technology. Things that, you know, 10 years ago we would have thought were the province of science fiction are now things that, you know, people are beginning to produce for our use. I remember being at a lunch at which one of the guests was Elon Musk, and somebody asked him about going to Mars and was that realistic and how long did he think it would take? And he said, 7 years. And somebody said, well, that seems like the day after tomorrow. Do you really think we could do this in 7 years? And he said, yes. You know? And that struck me as being an indication of this, that really things that were outrageous science fiction 5 minutes ago are now achievable the day after tomorrow.
I can't help thinking about Ray Kurzweil, who says, you know, we once thought that it would be impossible for us to fly, and why should we think that it's impossible for us to extend longevity to the point where we can be immortal?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that anything's impossible anymore. It's one of the problems. And I was just thinking about, you know, if my father were around today, the world in which I live, he would find completely unbelievable. I mean, that we have this phone in our pocket that could give us all the information we need or what we think of as the information that we need. These things are just beyond understanding to people of even one generation back.
Yeah, you hit a chord of memory. My father used to say, life goes so fast, it's like a jet plane, you know. Now we need other metaphors. We can't even extend these metaphors.
The jet plane is too slow.
That's exactly right. We're talking again with Salman Rushdie, and we're going to go to some calls now, and you can join us, I remind you, at 866-733-6786, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. And actually, here's a question for you from a listener who says, has your opinion of California changed?
Oh, I'm deeply in favor of California, I have to say. I always thought, and actually Northern California in particular, I always felt, when I decided to come and live in New York, that the only other place in America that I would consider living was San Francisco. And the reason I didn't is simply that I have family in England and it's just such a long schlep to get from one to the other. But I could completely see myself in the Bay Area. I think that would work quite well for me.
Let me bring some callers aboard. Sid is our first caller. Sid, welcome. You're on the air. Sid, are you there?
We all completely understand who voted for Trump, the people who were economically suffering and not educated in the middle America and everything. And the same thing happened with Boris, the rural parts of England and even farmers and the people who wanted Brexit and also uneducated, everything. But I don't understand one thing. The people in India, the at least people that I know of who voted for Modi are engineers, doctors, educated, and somehow they are for RSS and BJP, the party that he won the election from. And even in the United States, the people that are immigrants and the Indians, most of them support Modi and think that he's doing a great job and are for him, and they don't see the parallels and similarities between among Trump, Boris, and Modi. And so what do you have to say about that? I mean, it's not the uneducated people. It's not the economically suffering people from India that voted for him, but it's the educated people that supported him and voted for him.
Yeah, Salman?
You're quite right. You're quite right. And it's not only the educated people. He has a very he won an enormous landslide victory, and what he's done very successfully is to, in a way, to try and change the idea of India. India, when it became independent under the leadership of Gandhi and Nehru, was envisioned as a secularist, non-sectarian state, in which religion would have no role to play in the constitution or in the makeup of the state. And what he has done is to talk to the very large Hindu majority, the 85% Hindu majority, and to say that those days are gone, and that what you need is a Hindu majoritarian approach to the country in which minorities become something like second-class citizens. And he's managed to sell that idea to a very large number of people, as you say, both in the Indian diaspora and in India itself. And that's the secret of his success. And it's quite right that he's popular. And I think it actually, to somebody who feels as I do, it means that the problems in India of growing authoritarianism and intolerance are less easily, it's less easy to see how they can be reversed than difficulties in this country. I also think it's, the British situation is coming very close to a point of irreversibility. I'm actually more optimistic about possibilities in America than in either of those other two countries.
Let me thank Sid for his call. Does it seem now as if India will be hegemonic in Kashmir and that will continue? I mean, one has to ask, what about the terrorism from Pakistan? And what about the pushback from Pakistan?
Well, I mean, the truth is that there were these jihadist groups coming across the border from Pakistan. Of late, they've been sort of very small and raggle-taggle groups. My worry is that this present burst of authoritarianism in Kashmir will re-energize people's willingness to respond violently. And I think that just means that things will go from bad to worse. I mean, right now, I think the issue is not even what one thinks of the intractable politics of Kashmir, but just that there's a human rights issue, which is very important right now. I mean, you have a state in which all communications have been shut down for more than 40 days now. And in which there's an enormous Indian military presence and all kinds of reports of maltreatment of Kashmiri citizens. And this is not a way in which a democracy ought to behave.
Our guest is Salman Rushdie, and his newest novel is Kishat. And he will be, by the way, appearing Friday at 7 p.m. with Berkeley Arts and Letters at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, and Saturday at 1 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera. And let me go to Sky, our next caller. Sky, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I want to return to the question of Maya and illusion and the real danger that happens with the blurring between fact and fiction in our media and in our politicians' words is that those fictions become more true because people respond to them and react to them, as I think you would probably agree. And over time, the fictions become the facts. And so my question is, it's easy to think of TV as a wasteland or the programming as the problem, but what role do the individual citizens have? What responsibility do we have in our interpretation of the news and our growing as human beings in order to really find what is true rather than just taking what we're fed?
Salman Rushdie.
And I think in a way, I think your question contains the answer. I mean, I think we do have to all see it as being our responsibility to distinguish truth from lies. And I think, one of the things that has been a traditional role of literature at times like these, when political leaders or political climates begin to mess around with the facts, that literature becomes a place from which people hear the truth. During the long reign of the Soviets, of the Soviet Union, we all understood that what was then called Samizdat literature was the place where we were being told the reality of what was happening in the Soviet Union, whereas the official versions were all lies. So I think it is a thing as writers, I think that I and I think many other writers feel in a time like this, paradoxically, if you like, it becomes the business of fiction to find ways of telling the truth.
And that fiction does not have to be realistic or proceed
no.
through verisimilitude. When you have crickets speaking Italian, or when you have humans turning into mastodons, for example, and you've often been described as a magic realist writer, you don't have to observe the borders of truth. You can do it through illusion.
No.
Maya.
I think we all understand metaphor. You know, we're all brought up to understand metaphor. And the town in, there's a chapter in the novel in which there's a town in New Jersey in which some of the inhabitants are turning into mastodons. There is, as far as I know, not a town in New Jersey in which this is really happening as of now. But where it came from was that when I was at university, I took part in a production of Ionesco's famous play Rhinoceros,
yes.
in which people in a small French town are turning into rhinoceroses. And I was one of those people who has had to turn into a rhinoceros. And that's a play written a long time ago now, which is about Nazism. It's about fascism. It's about how the people living next door to you, the people with whose children your children were playing yesterday, that those people can suddenly turn into monsters. That you're in your own community, there can be people from whom you feel so alienated that you're unable anymore to communicate with them, and that you can even find them frightening. That's what Ionesco was writing about, more than half a century ago. And I felt a little bit that we're sort of back in that moment right now, where we live in a moment where our neighbors can suddenly become alien to us and difficult to communicate with, and sometimes even frightening. I don't want to go into the... I can just mention gun violence as one way of understanding this. So I thought, well, I can't have rhinoceroses because Ionesco's got rhinoceroses. So I'll have mastodons as my metaphor. Pink elephants in New Jersey.
Here's another caller. Blake joins us. Blake, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hi, Salman. I'm a big fan of Christopher Hitchens. I'm a millennial
yes.
who encountered him through YouTube shortly after his passing. Excuse me. I'm curious what you. I know that you were a dear friend of his, and I'm curious what you think he would think of Trump and the current the current present moment.
That's a splendid question, and Salman Rushdie was a good friend of Christopher Hitchens, and I'm privileged to have called him a friend as well. What do you think Hitch would be saying about Trump? It's an excellent question.
Oh, I think he would despise Trump because Christopher, apart from anything else, disliked people who didn't have any real knowledge of the world. You know, Christopher was one of these people who had an enormous amount of knowledge that he carried around with him. You know, and one of the things he could do better than anyone I've ever known was recite poetry. You know, you could say to Christopher, Byron, and he would do like 20 minutes. You know, so he respected knowledge. He respected all the things that Trump doesn't respect, which he calls elitist. So he would dislike Trump, I have no doubt. But I think he would have had a problem in the 2016 election, because Christopher despised the Clintons too.
Yes,
Christopher hated the Clintons, and so he would have found it really quite difficult to be enthusiastic about the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. I wish he had been around, because I would have liked to see him wrestle with that.
You think he might have been drawn to, he was pretty much on the left, except when the Iraq war took place. You think he would have been drawn to somebody like Sanders or Walker, for that matter?
He might have done. We can't say, because, we need his voice maybe more than ever, and we don't have it. So the rest of us have to do our best to fill in.
Here's Stephen, who asked, do you think that India could have succeeded as a singular nation without the partitions of Pakistan and Bangladesh? Interesting question.
Oh, now you're asking about once upon a time.
I misspoke. I said Walker, and I meant Elizabeth Warren, so I have to correct that.
Oh, yes,
so,
yes. I think in the period of the independence movement, during the latter stages of the British Empire, I think there were moments at which it was possible to envisage the independence of an undivided country. But by the early 1940s, those political divisions had appeared, and it became, from that point on, I think, quite difficult to see an unpartitioned India because of the split between the Congress Party and the Muslim League. So this is all ancient history now. I mean, I think, frankly, we just have to accept the world as it is. You know, there just is India and Pakistan, and they used to be very different. Now I fear that India is becoming a little bit more like Pakistan.
Speaking of ancient history, when you alluded to, well, the division in this country that existed, particularly when Trump and Clinton, and may have existed in Christopher Hitchens' mind and heart, I couldn't help thinking about the class divide, despite the fact that Trump comes from a great deal of money and inherited a great deal of money. I'm wondering about in India now. There are those who say the caste system is gone. It's something of the. It's a relic of the past. It doesn't exist anymore.
But it's not.
It still exists, vestigial in other ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very powerful. I mean, it's enormously powerful outside the cities, but it's still pretty powerful inside the cities. So you don't see that even now in... You don't see a whole lot of marriages across caste borders, you know. I mean, I'm somebody who's always thought that the caste system was one of the things holding India back from genuinely entering the modern world. And I think that, unfortunately, it's still the case. I mean, it doesn't come into my book because my book doesn't take place really in that community. But it is one of the problems, yeah, that India has to wrestle with.
And we bring on Steve next. Steve, thank you for waiting. Join us.
Hi. I just wanted to say that Philip Roth encountered the same difficulty 50, 60 years ago with Portnoy's complaint when he was so heavily criticized for having his protagonist violate a piece of liver behind a billboard. And his response was, the greatest challenge to the writer of fiction today is the bizarre reality around him. How do I compete with Dwight David Eisenhower putting ruined metaphors down the American fairway?
Now that was the essay I was alluding to, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had to reread the works of Philip Roth recently because I was asked to deliver a memorial lecture to him. And looking at Portnoy's complaint now, what is interesting, I thought, is that it has lost none of its power to shock. In many ways, because we've become more sensitive to certain kinds of offense, it may actually be more shocking now than it was when it came out. But it saves itself by being extremely funny. I mean, it is still very difficult to read Portnoy's complaint without laughing aloud.
It's a hilarious. It's a shtick, really. It's a whole shtick.
Yeah. Yes, it's like stand-up. I mean, it's like somebody sitting down to do stand-up comedy.
Except as shocking as that novel was when it was published, and I've written about this, I took my daughter when she was a teenager to look for books, and there it was in the teen library section of reading, which, you know.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a true story and something that still is a bit shocking to remember. Let me thank Steve for that call. Steve, appreciate hearing from you. Let's hear next from Mary. Mary, join us.
Hello. It's very nice to speak with you, Michael. I'm really glad that you have Jim Bennett working for you. He's an excellent sound engineer. He was the one who trained me. And I'm really happy to hear Salman on the line. Welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you.
So my question is, so I'm kind of a fledgling writer. I do 30 minutes a day, but I haven't yet published anything. So any advice that you could give me on publishing or like getting over that?
Well, I think maybe,
you know?
I would say maybe do a little bit more than 30 minutes a day.
You know, all right.
Maybe take it up to an hour a day. I mean, I think the secret of writing is to get something finished. I mean, I've always felt all my life that when I get to the end of whatever I'm doing, I'm able to look at it much more objectively. I can actually see what's wrong with it, what needs fixing, what needs cutting out, adding to. Just having something down in a finished form is a really clarifying way of getting your work done. So I would say whatever story it is that you're working on, just try and get a draft of it down, however rough that is. Just get to the end, and then you can look at it and see what you've done and see what it needs.
And good luck to you, Mary, as a fledgling author. I think you got some excellent advice from a great author. The great author is Salman Rushdie, of course. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Let me go to another caller here, and that's Raj. Raj, you're on the air with us. Good morning.
Thanks, Michael. Salman, another wonderful novel from you, and I'll just quote a quick line to ask a question. Quote, this is what he said when he was questioned, that he was not rootless, not uprooted, but transplanted, or even better, multiply rooted, like an old bunion tree, putting down prop roots as it spread, which thickened and in time became indistinguishable from the original trunk. Too many roots. It meant his stories had a broader canopy beneath which to shelter from the scorching, hostile sun. So I quote this because I'm reminded of Naipaul, who obviously passed away a year ago, and his enigma of arrival, which very much suggested that he did put down roots, and those roots were very much in England. So the question for you is, where are roots now for you?
I like Naipaul because I think he, in a way, tried to get away from his origins. You know, he tried to get away from the West Indies, and he never really deeply identified with his Indian heritage. And he was actually very critical of it in some of his books. I feel like the character in the passage you've just read, that I have multiple roots, you know, that I have roots, in, very deep roots in India. I still think of Bombay as, in some way, as my hometown, because I think the place you grew up, the place you were a child and grew up, is has that feeling for you all your life. I have very deep roots in London. I mean, most of my close family and a lot of my closest friends are there. And I've now lived in New York for 20 years, so I certainly feel very much at home there. So I don't think this is even unusual anymore. You know, I think that we live in an age in which so many people move across the world, you know, end up making lives in places which are not the places in which they began, that we all have this sense of multiple roots. We all have the sense of being rooted in the place where we live, but also having roots in the place that we came from. You know, so I think this has become almost a new normal.
Let me thank Raj for the call. I'm reminded of the fact that it's a very funny story, but a story that occurred in that troubling period of your life, which you write about so brilliantly in Joseph Anton, when you were under the fatwa, when Naipaul was told about the fatwa, and he said, this is the most serious form of literary criticism. I mean, it's a great quip, but, you know, in the face of horror.
I know. Many, many years later, actually, the last time I ever met Naipaul, he tried to apologize for that quip. And he said to me that he hadn't meant any harm by it, that it was a joke. And I said to him, look, you know, actually, I know it was a joke because I know what a joke is, and that's a joke. You know? And he said, yes, I'd never meant anything bad. And it was as if this elderly gentleman, not very well at all by that time, in a wheelchair, was trying to make amends and put down burdens he'd been carrying. And I mean, wandering around London saying sorry to people for his many things he'd done during his life which upset people.
I wonder if you ever apologized to Paul Theroux. You know the story about Paul Theroux writing a book with great dedication. In fact, Paul Theroux wrote a book because he worshipped Naipaul, wrote a great dedication to him, and found it in one of these books that was sold secondhand with the dedication.
No, I mean, actually, I believe I'm right in saying that Ian McEwan was the person who effected a peacemaking moment between Paul Theroux and V.S. Naipaul at some literary festival that they were all at. And so I think there was a kind of reconciliation towards the end of Naipaul's life.
Oh, that's good to hear. And we'll hear from another caller. A.D. joins us. Good morning. A.D., are you there?
As always, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now. Go ahead, please.
Okay, cool. Hey, Michael, great show. As always, great guest. I just want one comment. I think your guest just mentioned India is now following path of Pakistan, and I just want to get some more insight when he made his comment, what his thoughts are behind that. And I just want to add one more comment, just because USA and India has a nationalist party ruling, but I think we want to may give consideration to who is leading that party, because I think Mr. Trump as a president and Mr. Modi, even though they belong to the same nationalist group.
Okay, forgive me, AD. We have seconds left. Salman Rushdie, please.
Yeah, I just think what I meant by saying India and Pakistan are getting a bit more like each other is that religion as a driving force is becoming more important in India than it used to be. And for someone who is secularist like myself and who believes in the original dream of India as a secularist nation, I regret that.
And it's going to cause, unfortunately, probably more bad things ahead between Muslims and Hindus, no?
Yes, perhaps.
Yeah, unfortunately. But let me thank you again for this novel, and thank you always for being with us. Pleasure to have you on, and a privilege. The novel is called Quixote Again, and it's by Salman Rushdie, and hope to see you in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you. Always happy to see you, Michael.
And we are here with you, happy to be with you, Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.